Wednesday, October 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, national security officials warn Americans about foreign disinformation campaigns ahead of the presidential election.
To get U.S. voters to change how they're going to vote or to change how they perceive the election, that is, change their view of the election from something that's legitimate to something where they're trying to convince American voters that things went wrong, this isn't a legitimate election, and therefore to doubt the process, to doubt democracy.
Witnesses say soldiers in Nigeria have opened fire on anti-police brutality protesters. Also ahead, what doctors are saying about the impacts of COVID-19 on pregnant women. It's all on today's International Edition. With 2 weeks to go until the presidential election, U.S. government officials are again expressing concern and urging vigilance about foreign interference. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden joins us for the latest. Jeff, we've been hearing about election security concerns, both foreign and domestic, for months now. What is this latest warning to come out on Tuesday?
Government officials in the U.S. are sounding the alarm about not so much what they think is going to happen in terms of any cyber attacks or anything that physically could impact the election and the election process in the U.S., but more disinformation and the idea that foreign adversaries could start to sow some distrust in the process. Specifically, the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which has really spearheaded the U.S. efforts on election security, put out a statement saying that now is, quote, the perfect time for our adversaries to launch efforts intended to undermine your confidence. And he was really speaking to American voters saying, look, the U.S. does not see any indications that foreign adversaries have been able to infiltrate critical systems. The U.S. has not seen any indications that adversaries can do anything that would actually change votes once they are cast. But given the timing and given how different this election is from all others, they say that there's a high likelihood that there will be disinformation campaigns, influence operations by U.S. adversaries that will get Americans to start doubting the process. And that's what they're trying to guard against.
Are they giving any specifics on what they're seeing or hearing?
They haven't given any specifics about any disinformation operations or influence operations from countries like China, Russia, or Iran. Although there have been warnings out there that the Chinese are doing things trying to help Biden's campaign and hurt Trump's campaign. The Russians have been trying to, in the words of U.S. counterintelligence officials, trying to denigrate the Biden campaign, and some Kremlin-linked entities have been trying to boost the campaign of President Trump. But for the most part, what they're saying here is that be prepared for the unknown. And what the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency has said, what other U.S. counterintelligence officials have said, is that really voters, American voters, are the last line of defense. And so that they want voters to be prepared. Understand, first of all, that given the vast amount, the record number of mail-in ballots, there's a good chance that the U.S. will not be able to call a winner in the presidential election on election night. Be prepared for that. That should not be something that's unusual or give you cause for alarm, they're telling voters. They're also telling voters to look for trusted sources of information. They're telling voters, don't believe anything that you see randomly on social media, but look to verified accounts from election officials or the websites of election officials. And then they say also voters should be responsible. Only share information from trusted sources, from actual election officials, verified accounts from state or local or even federal officials. And also they're asking voters, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your neighbors not to share sensational but unverified information about the election. They're trying to get Americans to make sure if there's any influence operation out there that's trying to sow chaos, to sow panic, that Americans don't help it out by repeating it and that they only trust officials when they say this is what's actually going on.
Okay. So basically what I'm hearing is that they're warning of foreign entities potentially looking to sow chaos and sort of uncertainty about the legitimacy of the votes rather than actually trying to change votes.
Right. So there are a couple of things that people tend to worry about. The first thing is, can somebody come in, a foreign adversary, a country like Russia, trying to go in, do something to the election system, the computer systems, and change the way that they voted? U.S. officials say that is almost impossible, highly unlikely, and that they haven't seen any indications that Russia, China, or anybody else is trying to do that. What they are worried about, though, is something that's a little bit easier for a country like Russia or China or another cyber actor to carry off. That's a disinformation campaign to get U.S. voters to change how they're going to vote or to change how they perceive the election. That is, change their view of the election from something that's legitimate to something where they're trying to convince American voters that things went wrong. This isn't isn't a legitimate election, and therefore to doubt the process, to doubt democracy. That's something that counterintelligence officials have been warning Russia's been trying to do going all the way back to 2016 and that election.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. From making sure voters are eligible to cast a ballot to tracking and reporting results, local election officials are key players in the U.S. presidential election. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Inglesias reports on what they're doing to make the voting fair and safe.
In this pandemic, plexiglass barriers, masks, and hand sanitizers are essential tools, not just for safety, but for U.S. democracy.
We've added social distancing markers to ensure that everyone's respecting that six-foot requirement. We do ask that all voters wear masks when they enter the polling place. And we're using one-time-use-only pens, disposable privacy folders.
Angie Maniglia-Turner is a top elections official in the city of Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. The November 3rd presidential vote is a national election, but it is local officials supervised by her who do the critical work of counting votes and mailing ballots. By mid-October, almost 17,000 people had voted in person at this Office of Elections.
I didn't want to risk it getting lost in the mail or that I filled out the wrong form or anything like that.
It's part of an unprecedented torrent of early voting nationwide. Record numbers will be casting ballots in person or by mail. Here, the votes won't be counted until 7 p.m. on election day. But early ballots can be pre-processed to get results faster.
Checking that the voter has done everything properly, that the ballot was returned marked, that has all the signatures that are needed.
How this works varies from state to state, though. Important swing states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania can't even open ballots until election day. And that could mean delays in calling the winner. Across the country, elections offices are in high gear. The city of Alexandria is training 600 election officials who will serve at 30 polling stations.
You have the poll books. Those are electronic poll books that are used to check in voters, machines that are scanning the ballots on election day and counting those. And then there are also the accessible machines.
The officers, who are paid an average of $150, are also trained to watch for polling place emergencies or disruptions.
You can't be within 40 feet of the entrance to the polling place, so if anyone is harassing voters in that area, I will tell them they have to move away. But if it goes beyond that, then I'll have to call in the police to help.
We're not here to represent any one party. We're doing this on behalf of our state. And our fellow citizens, and we don't care who you vote for. We just want to make sure that you are able to vote safely and securely.
In 2018, the Election Administration and Voting Survey found that half of U.S. poll workers were age 61 or older, a group at higher risk from COVID-19. Here in the city of Alexandria, they say taking that risk is worth it.
The fact that we are here indicates our commitment, and I think gives a good example to the citizens that also come out. But it's also important to make sure that this election, particularly this year, is a fair and honest one.
Veronica Valeras Iglesias for VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Well, doctors know that viruses can affect pregnant women and their developing fetuses, and now they are scrambling to understand the effects of COVID-19 on pregnancies. We hear more now from VOA's Carol Pearson.
When a woman is pregnant, her immune system changes to protect her growing baby. But these changes make her more vulnerable to certain viruses, such as the flu, and increase her risk of serious health problems. So far, studies about pregnant women infected with the new coronavirus show both reassuring and alarming results. The Cleveland Clinic's Dr. Tosin Gogi says recent evidence suggests pregnant women may face more severe health problems if they have COVID-19.
They had increased hospitalization, and they had increased ICU admission, and they had increased receipt of a mechanical ventilation when they compared them to women of the same reproductive age with COVID-19 that were not pregnant.
Doctors are trying to determine if COVID-19 is more dangerous for pregnant women than getting the flu. Dr. Brenna Hughes is a maternal and fetal medicine physician at Duke University.
It appears at this point that it is actually not as severe as influenza is during pregnancy.
Yet the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says pregnant women who get COVID-19 and are hospitalized have higher rates of serious illnesses, are more likely to have miscarriages, deliver babies prematurely, and more likely to have stillborn babies. Other studies contradict these results.
I think that we need to take a step back a little bit in that since COVID-19 is so new, we don't have all of the data that we really need to make an assessment as to what level of risk it imparts on a pregnant woman.
For example, could stress be a factor? Pandemic-related hurdles to prenatal care, like lockdowns, prevented some women from getting checkups or even getting medical care when giving birth. Some women put off seeing their doctors out of fear of getting the coronavirus. Dr. Hughes says women need to see their doctors in their last trimester.
Prenatal care, particularly in the third trimester, is one of the ways that we ensure both mother's health and ensure that there aren't stillbirths.
Until more is known, pregnant women need to protect themselves from the coronavirus by wearing face masks, social distancing, avoiding crowds, and practicing good hand hygiene. Doctors say women also need to call their physician if they notice decreased fetal movement. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Armenia and Azerbaijan said Tuesday that foreign ministers will meet U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Washington Friday in efforts to end the heaviest fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh since the 1990s. The State Department did not immediately comment, but the planned meeting suggests that just before the U.S. presidential election, Washington is stepping up involvement and moves to calm a conflict that has killed hundreds of people since September 27th. A senior delegation from the United Arab Emirates arrived in Israel for the first official visit since the two countries signed a peace agreement last month. They signed a series of bilateral agreements, including a visa waiver agreement. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
A very happy Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcomed the UAE delegation, saying, "Today we are making history."
The enthusiasm for this peace agreement among our peoples is enormous. It's real, it's broad, it's deep, and it reflects the potential that is being realized today.
One of the agreements says that Israelis will not need visas to visit the UAE, and Emiratis can visit Israel freely as well. With direct flights expected to start by January, the Israeli tourist industry, which has been hit hard by COVID-19, hopes for 250,000 Emiratis to visit a year. Some Israeli tour companies are already marketing trips to Abu Dhabi and Dubai. The two also inaugurated a $3 billion trilateral fund among Israel, the UAE, and the U.S. to encourage investment. For Mr. Netanyahu, the UAE's short delegation visit was a welcome break from his electoral woes. His popularity has plummeted amid criticism of his handling of the pandemic, and his trial on several charges of corruption is set to start in January. President Trump also hopes the accord, which was signed last month in Washington, will give him an electoral boost. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the accords could transform the Middle East.
The Abraham Accords established direct economic ties between two of the Middle East's most thriving and advanced economies. These ties create a tremendous foundation for economic growth, opportunity, innovation, and prosperity.
For the UAE, Israel offers high-tech innovation and business opportunities. UAE Minister of State for Financial Affairs, Obaid Huamed Al-Tayer, said both countries offer opportunities.
The UAE will continue to be regional leader in terms of economic reforms, openness in international trade, political stability, and peacemaking. The economic cooperation in finance and investment between the UAE and Israel will be realized after signing today the agreement for the promotion and protection of investment.
Because of the COVID-19, the delegation did not leave the area of the airport. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu invited them back for a sightseeing trip when the pandemic passes. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Soldiers opened fire on Nigerians protesting against police brutality in the Lekki district of the commercial capital Lagos on Tuesday, shooting at least two people, according to witnesses' reports to Reuters News. Thousands of Nigerians have been demonstrating nationwide every day for nearly 2 weeks against a police unit that rights groups had for years accused of extortion, harassment, torture, and murders. A pledging conference on the humanitarian crisis in Africa's central Sahel region has fallen short of its $2.4 billion mark, but organizers say they expect more pledges to come flowing in over the coming months. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations, together with Denmark, Germany, and the European Union, co-hosts of this ministerial conference, say they are encouraged by the strong showing of international support for the people of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. They call the meeting a substantial success based on the pledges already made and the promise of more to come. They set out to raise the profile of this region, which has largely been overlooked, and to raise awareness of the enormous needs of tens of millions of people faced with one of the world's worst humanitarian emergencies. And this, they say, has largely been accomplished. The Danish Minister for Development Cooperation, Rasmus Prehn, says the humanitarian situation in the Central Sahel region is rapidly worsening. He says people are suffering from rising insecurity due to armed conflict, increased displacement, the negative effects of climate change and extreme weather, and now COVID-19.
30.4 million people, that is one-fifth of the population in the region, need life-saving support and protection. This year alone, the future of millions is at stake. That is why we need to step up our efforts. We need to secure access to basic social services, justice, economic opportunities, and security.
UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock says there needs to be a comprehensive response to the Sahel crisis. Just focusing on a few areas, he says, will not solve the huge problems confronting the region. He tells VOA there needs to be a military response to deal with the terrorist extremists who are taking control of large areas of land. He says sustaining humanitarian assistance is needed to keep people alive, but bigger investments are needed in human development, education, water and sanitation, and other essential services. He says much greater effort and investment is needed to diversify the economy of the region.
Improving the efficiency of agriculture, freeing up more people to work in other sectors, especially towns and cities, and the economic development of the area to create more opportunities for everybody and to give people hope about the future so that it's clear that the nihilistic agenda of the extremists is countered by a better alternative.
Conference organizers agree humanitarian aid is not a long-term solution. They say emergency life-saving assistance cannot go on for years and years, and that durable solutions must be found. For this to happen, they agree governments, local communities, and the international community must address the root causes of this humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. Last week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a new Ebola treatment called Inmazeb, made by the company Regeneron. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar hailed the drug as a momentous global health achievement, which could help African countries fight Ebola outbreaks. An ongoing Ebola outbreak in Western Democratic Republic of Congo has killed over 50 people since May. To find out more about the new drug and what it means in the fight against Ebola, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with emergency physician and epidemiologist Armand Sprecher, who has helped respond to Ebola outbreaks with the medical aid group MSF, or Doctors Without Borders.
Armand, how does this drug work to fight Ebola?
I guess the simplest way to think about it was, if you got Ebola and survived, what would get you through your infection would be your immune system. A large part of that, especially towards the end of illness, would be a response based on antibodies that your body made to fight off the infection. This product is essentially antibodies similar to the ones that you would have made on your own. So these antibodies would provide your body with a similar immune response, something that would fight off infection, ideally before you got ill.
And how effective does this treatment appear to be?
The best indication we have is from a study that was done in the Democratic Republic of the Congo during the, not current, but previous outbreak in the eastern DRC. They did a study on somewhere around between 700 and 800 patients, a quarter of whom roughly received this treatment. The mortality in this group, the proportion of people who died, was somewhere between 30 and 35%, whereas people treated with other therapeutic agents, for example, those who got ZMapp or remdesivir, which is in the news a lot now, their mortality, the proportion of people that died, was sort of in the 50% range. So we know that this drug is more effective than other therapeutics that we've tried.
And how safe is this treatment? Any serious side effects?
It appears rather safe. It does not appear that the patients who received this drug had any downstream problems that weren't mostly consistent with just their having Ebola virus. Where MSF was delivering the drugs, because we participated in the trials that developed the evidence for this drug, none of the reports that I saw were consistent with a adverse effect from the drug.
Now, there have been some accusations recently of politicization of the FDA's approval process in relation to COVID-19 treatments. Do you have any concerns about the approval process for this Ebola treatment?
No, I don't. The clinical trial on which this drug's approval is based was done back in the 2018-2019 outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri. So that was well before we were becoming alarmed about potential manipulation of the approval process. So the drug has demonstrated its safety and efficacy in advance of our current concerns. And the administrative procedures to gain approval were started well before. And this has been in the works for some time. And the announcement of the approval now comes as no surprise. So I don't feel like this was unduly accelerated or is coming ahead of schedule.
And does MSF plan to administer this drug to treat Ebola?
Yeah, we have to make sure that it's available. So we are hoping it will be available for our use in the future. And to the extent that we can just buy it off the shelf, we're ready to do that.
Last of all, what impact will this treatment have on combating Ebola outbreaks, including the current outbreak in the DRC?
The absence of a therapeutic has always been a problem, because what you need to do to control outbreaks is to get people with the disease to come to a place where they can be cared for in an environment where their infection risk to others, healthcare staff, family, people in the community, is controlled. Their incentive for coming is rather meager when you don't have a therapeutic option to offer them. So it had always been our great hope that we would one day have a therapeutic agent that would provide a benefit to the patient to come to us. So this has been something we've been waiting for a long time. However, what we learned in that outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri was that this only works if people have confidence and trust in the healthcare agencies that are providing the therapeutic. So this is a great tool, or a tool with great potential, not only for saving lives, but for controlling outbreaks. But it will only work as a tool if people have confidence not only in the drug itself, but in the agencies that are making that drug available. and we have not yet perfected a way to win over mistrustful communities during these outbreaks, because the outbreaks themselves stir mistrust.
Emergency physician and epidemiologist Armand Sprecher speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin.
Thousands of Aboriginal Australians are expected to join a class action lawsuit that's been filed against the West Australian government for compensation for years of unpaid work. Historians have said that at the time, the authorities knew the practice was a form of slavery. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
In the 19th and 20th centuries, Indigenous children as young as four were forcibly taken from their families to work in mines on farms and as domestic servants in Australia. Many received little or no wages, and some were paid only with bread and beef. Lawyers have said conditions were akin to slavery. Until the 1970s, wages earned by Indigenous workers in Western Australia were paid to the state government, but rarely was the money passed on. Lawyers have said as many as 10,000 workers and their descendants would be eligible to join the stolen wages class action lawsuit, which has been filed in Australia's federal court. Jan Sadler is the head of class actions at Shine Lawyers, a legal firm that is leading the court case.
We've been talking to Indigenous Western Australians who are well into their 70s and 80s. Those people have effectively been waiting all their lives to be properly compensated. They're actually waiting to receive their wages from the 1940s and the 1950s, and they still haven't been paid. And this is what that claim is all about.
Up until the late 1970s, Australia's laws controlled every aspect of Indigenous people's lives, from buying clothes to whether they could marry. They also allowed wages to be withheld. The Western Australian state government, which is being sued for compensation, has said it hopes a mediated settlement can be reached. Multi-million dollar reparation schemes have compensated Indigenous workers in the states of Queensland and New South Wales. A previous restitution program in Western Australia limited claimants to payments of $1,400 and came with strict conditions. Campaigners said it was too restricted and didn't go far enough to address the injustices of the past. A federal parliamentary inquiry in 2006 tried to determine how much money may have been stolen from Aboriginal Australians over the decades, but lawmakers found that wage theft was so widespread, the amount was almost impossible to calculate. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Film fans will soon have the chance to get their hands on the thigh-high patent leather boots worn by Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, or Tom Cruise's Top Gun bomber jacket, when nearly 1,000 items of movie memorabilia go on sale in an auction in December. The artifacts in the annual Prop Store Entertainment Memorabilia Live Auction have been hunted down by prop store boss Stephen Lane through his network of filmmakers, cast and crew members, production companies, and collectors. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks for being with us.